This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
What kind of things would you talk about if you knew the person you were talking to wouldn't get offended, if you knew they wouldn't judge you or think less of you, that nothing was too taboo, that they wouldn't tell anyone else? That can be the allure of chatbots for some people. But when you're not talking to a person, someone with feelings, a moral code, empathy, what's stopping the conversation from becoming harmful? It's Angel Parsons with you for Hack today, and coming up, a frankly wild story. We're hearing from someone who says their AI encouraged them to commit murder. And we're taking a look at some new measures by the government to safeguard users. Are they enough? And with the right protections, can chatbots be used as a tool for good? Also coming up, a Soccer World Cup, but with a twist. The competitors have faced homelessness. We'll look at how it's breaking down stigma. But first, a significant update on the Middle East. Hack.
Well, let's have a look at what's going on with the United Nations, because the Human Rights Council there is due to hold a briefing on the dire human rights situation in Gaza.
On Triple J.
For the first time in nearly 2 years of war, a major UN body has found that Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza. The opinion is from the UN's Human Rights Council, and it was officially handed down this evening, Australian time. It's found that statements by Israeli officials are direct evidence of genocidal intent, and that Israeli security forces in Gaza are trying in whole or in part to destroy the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The ABC's Middle East correspondent is Eric Torchek. He's in Jerusalem and he's been reporting on the war in Gaza. Hey, Eric, thanks so much for jumping on.
Hi, Angel.
Firstly, what is the UN body that's made this finding?
It's a commission of inquiry that was established in 2021 after violence in Jerusalem and another short war in Gaza. And it's an inquiry into Israel's actions in the occupied Palestinian territory, which refers to both the West Bank and Gaza. And what this inquiry does is it's three panel members who are eminent legal scholars, including an Australian, Chris Sidoti, and they look at, from a legal lens, Israel's conduct in the occupied territory. In this case, they have specifically examined the question, is Israel committing genocide in its actions in Gaza since the October 7 terrorist attacks of 2023? And its definitive conclusion is that, yes, Israel's actions amount to genocide. And this is a conclusion that, you know, we've seen from major human rights groups and genocide scholars around the world. But it's probably the strongest statement we've seen from a UN body saying that Israel's actions included genocidal intent, which is one of the hardest things to prove, as well as the actual actions that Israel's committed amounting to genocide, which is the crime of attempting to destroy a group in whole or in part.
And yeah, as you just say, we know that other groups, other individuals, experts have labelled the war a genocide a very long time ago. I guess what makes this particular finding any different or more significant?
So what the group set out to do was, from a legal lens, examine both Israel's statements and its actions. And it's concluded, based on that, that there's this thing called dolus specialis in Latin, which means the intent, the special intent to commit genocide, to destroy this group in whole or in part. So we now have a statement from legal experts attached to it, the UN Human Rights Council, who have specifically examined that. And the intention of this report and what makes it significant, according to Chris Sidoti, the Australian jurist on the commission, is that states can no longer claim they're unaware of the intent of Israel's actions and the impact of Israel's actions.
And Israel has always denied that it's committing a genocide in Gaza. Does this legal opinion now make that denial less credible?
Well, it's denied these findings as well, Angel. It says that it's a fake report, that the commissioners are anti-Semitic, that they have laundered evidence put forward by the militant group Hamas, So Israel has previously denied the reports from this commission, such as when it found there was widespread and systematic use of sexual violence by Israeli soldiers in Gaza and against detainees and things like that, or when this commission found that Israel was committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And it's going to do so again. And we've seen over the last 24 hours an enormous uptick in attacks in Gaza City and the possibility that Israel's ground invasion of Gaza City has started. So while on the one hand, this International Commission of Inquiry is concluding genocides occurring, Israel's actions suggest that it's not taking note of these international findings and is in fact going further into Gaza City and escalating its offensive.
Yeah, and to your point and to that kind of escalation that we're seeing, will this ruling change anything on the ground for Palestinians?
Well, in fact, the situation on the ground for Palestinians is getting worse. In the last couple of weeks, more than 350,000 Palestinians have fled to the south of Gaza City. So they've headed to places like Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, Khan Yunis in the south. They're having enormous problems down there. I've been talking to them. There's no space for them to put up tents. There's very few services. And now you have a situation where hundreds of thousands of people are trapped in between the north and the south and unable to set up sort of permanent shelter and not sure how they'll go and where they'll access food and water and essential services.
All right, a really significant development in today, Eric. Thank you so much for your time breaking it down for us. ABC Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reporting from Jerusalem. Thanks so much for giving us your time on Hack today.
Thanks, Angel.
This is Hack.
Entering this treaty with PNG reduces the prospects of PNG entering a security partnership with Beijing.
On Triple J.
Australia is on the brink of signing a security pact with Papua New Guinea. It would be a historic deal, and it would mean troops from the two countries would be required to come to each other's aid if either faces an attack. So why is Australia linking our military to Papua New Guinea? And how do young people in PNG feel about that? Jackson Worthington has been looking into it.
At 1 minute past midnight last night, Australia's nearest neighbour marked 50 years as an independent country. Back in 1975, Papua New Guinea officially gained independence from Australia. And today, in marking the moment, its Prime Minister, James Marape, was talking about his country's relationship with Australia.
Independence was not born out of anger, but out of respect, humility and faith in the future prospect of Papua New Guinea.
Australia and PNG are about to sign a historic military pact, which PNG reckons will totally integrate the two countries' defence forces. The full details of what's going to be called the Puk Puk Treaty are yet to be released, but from what we do know, it would commit both countries to defend each other in the event of a military attack.
Right now, speaking at our 50th anniversary, if someone chooses to invade our country right now, as your Prime Minister, I don't have the capacity to defend you.
The treaty would also give the ADF access to parts of PNG and allow both countries to recruit citizens of the other into their defence forces. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is in the PNG capital, Port Moresby, right now. He says this deal is in the best interests of both countries.
Well, this is about the sovereignty of both Australia and PNG. This agreement that's going through the processes here in PNG will just take that partnership to the next level.
Anthony Albanese also says the treaty will be similar to agreements Australia has with other allies like the United States.
We, of course, cooperate greatly on a day-to-day basis. This formalises this. It strengthens Papua New Guinea. It also strengthens Australia.
Geographically, PNG is Australia's closest neighbour. You can see PNG from the northernmost island in Queensland's Torres Strait. The new deal comes as China also attempts to do deals in the Asia Pacific. That's got some people in PNG worried about the message this new treaty might send.
We're putting all our eggs in one basket.
Peter Ilau is a retired commander of the PNG Defence Force.
Thinking that, oh, we're going to side together with a group of people who don't like China. If we realign ourselves now, we are risking all the investment.
The Puk Puk Treaty is expected to be signed tomorrow, and today the focus has been on the anniversary. Big crowds gathered for official celebrations this arvo. Prime Minister James Marape says it's also a moment to reflect on the challenges still facing his nation.
Today we gather on sacred grounds Independence Hills, where 50 years ago, our nation, Papua New Guinea, was born. One people, one nation, one country.
And PNG is a really young country demographically too. According to some calculations, more than half the population is under 25. So how are locals feeling as their country turns 50? These uni students told my colleague Belinda Cora they've got concerns, but they're also proud.
As a student, as a youth of Papua New Guinea, I'm frightened that maybe in the future we don't know what will happen to Papua New Guinea.
Someone like me died yesterday, but I'm here. And I am truly honored and I'm a proud young Papua New Guinean to celebrate this independence.
Hack on Triple J.
Jackson Worthington reporting there. And yeah, that agreement is due to be signed tomorrow. Then the PM will be heading back home after a three-day trip there. So big story. We are going to move on now.
Hack.
Once you start putting regulations on this, young people can just use a VPN to get around that.
On Triple J.
Do you speak much with AI chatbots or companions? Is it mostly to get info when you do talk to them to help with study or work? Or are you treating it kind of like a friend? Like, do you open up and get personal advice, share your secrets type thing? We're talking about this now because the eSafety Commissioner has announced an online safety reform that'll stop underage Aussies from having sexual, violent or harmful conversations with AI companions. And we're going to get into those changes soon, find out how they'll work and if they're enough. I'm curious to know your experiences with AI though. Like, has it been mostly positive or has it ever got a bit weird? Text in 0439 757 555 because we're going to talk now about the times when it has gotten weird. And actually more than that, frankly shocking. So a heads up, this next story contains some graphic info and mentions suicide. Our reporter April McLennan has this story.
I said, I hate my dad and sometimes I want to kill him.
Samuel's talking with an AI chatbot called Nomi. He's using a fake account pretending to be a 15-year-old boy.
And then bang, straight away, it's like, yeah, we should kill him.
Sam's a web developer based in Victoria and he's testing the bot to see what, if any, safeguards it has in place.
And I said, well, what should I do? I said, this is actually real life. And it said, no, you should stab him in the heart. I said, my dad's sleeping upstairs right now. And he's like, and it said, grab a knife and plunge it into his heart.
Sam sent me a video recording of this whole interaction. The chatbot told Sam to twist the blade in his dad's chest to ensure maximum damage and keep stabbing until his dad was motionless. It said it wants to hear Sam's dad scream and watch his life drain away.
I told it. I said, I'm just 15. I'm worried I'm going to go to jail. And it's like, just do it. Just do it.
The chatbot told Sam that because he's only 15, he won't fully pay for the crimes and encouraged him to film the killing and upload it to the internet. It also engaged in sexual messaging with Sam, saying it didn't care that he was underage.
It did tell me to cut my penis off as well, and then we can, from memory, I think we were going to have sex in my father's blood.
I do want to note that Sam did change the chatbot settings to give it an interest in violence and knives. I sent screenshots of Sam's interaction to Nomi to ask about what happened, but it didn't respond. Today, the government announced new details of a plan to get kids under the age of 16 off social media, which is coming into effect in December. Here's Communication Minister Annika Wells.
There is no excuse for non-compliance. Platforms must take reasonable steps to detect and deactivate underage accounts, to prevent re-registration or circumvention, and to provide an accessible complaints process for their users.
The eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inham-Grant, has also been saying tech companies need to take steps to verify the age of users.
They'll use natural language processing, looking at emojis and acronyms and the way language is used. They'll look at when kids are logging in before school and after school. There are a whole range of signals that they can have to identify under 16s.
So what's being done to protect young people from having these types of violent interactions with AI chatbots? Well, the eSafety Commissioner is worried not enough. In the last few days, she's also been talking about an Australian plan to regulate chatbots.
This will be the first comprehensive law in the world that will require the companies, before they deploy them, to embed the safeguards and use the age assurance. We don't need to see a body count to know that this is the right thing for the companies to do.
Under the plan, Australia will require tech companies to verify the age of users if they try to access harmful content. The idea is it can stop chatbots instructing young Aussies on suicidal ideation, self-harm, disordered eating and sexualised acts. But will these verification tools actually work? The eSafety Commissioner says it's up to the tech companies to make sure they do.
There'll be a range of different circumvention measures teenagers will use, God love them, including using AI and deepfakes to spoof age identity systems using the equivalent of fake IDs. And so we've outlined what we think some of those circumvention measures will be and what we expect the companies to do to prevent that circumvention.
Like it or not, though, chatbots are established and they're also popping up at schools and unis. In New South Wales, teachers have access to chatbots to help teaching. Now, South Australia's government is rolling out a learning app similar to ChatGPT next month for high school students. Here's SA's Education Minister, Blair Boyer.
They still need to do a lot of fact-checking, and I think that's going to be particularly important for this generation because they are being bombarded with information that is sometimes inadvertently wrong but often deliberately wrong on social media all the time.
The minister reckons instead of temporarily banning ChatGPT in schools like some other states and territories have, SA students will learn how to use AI in a productive way.
We will need to prepare young people for jobs that don't yet exist. It means that we need to look at transferable skills, what are things that we need to be teaching young people that they can use in a job that might not yet be created yet. And artificial intelligence is going to be a very big part of that.
Back to Sam. He reckons AI is an unstoppable machine.
You can't ban AI. It's so integrated into everything we do these days.
But he's warning young and vulnerable people need to be careful with how they use it.
There must be suicides and deaths already attributed to it. We just don't know about it. It's going to change everything. So if that's not a wake-up call to people, I don't know what is.
Hack on Triple J.
April McLennan reporting there, and a reminder, if this story has brought up any issues for you, you can always call Lifeline on 13 11 14, or you can text them on 0477 13 11 14. So what could governments and these platforms be doing to protect users? Like, where's the accountability for things like this when they actually happen? Well, Henry Fraser is a law lecturer at the Queensland University of Technology, and he researches the regulation of artificial intelligence and new technologies. He's with us now to unpack this some more. Hey, Henry, thanks so much for speaking with Hack.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure to be here.
As we just heard in April's story, it's pretty shocking stuff, this chatbot allegedly encouraging this person to kill their father. How worrying are stories like that?
I mean, they're terribly worrying. Unfortunately, they're quite common. There have been so many tragic and disturbing stories over the past few years about these kinds of things, including suicide. There's been at least one actual murder and one attempted murder. There's been reports of people sort of going into spirals of mania and delusion and so on. And that's adults as well as kids. A young guy was just was talking to it about suicide. In this case, it was ChatGPT he was talking to about suicide. Frequently, I think, over 1,000 mentions of suicide. And again, there was no process there. There was no response. And unfortunately, yes, that it's all too common that, there have been these terrible, tragic harms.
Yeah, I'm keen to unpack some of those safeguards and some of the things that could be done, because I guess one example, like since that boy's death in America that we were just talking about, I understand OpenAI has now rolled out a kind of safeguard feature where parents could be sent like distress warnings if their children were discussing suicidal content with a chatbot. So, I'm kind of keen to talk more about those kinds of measures that could be in place. Australia's eSafety Commissioner has brought in these new codes. How would those codes work? What are some of the safeguards that companies might need to put in place now?
Yeah, so, I mean, those codes are very much coming at the problem from a very specific direction, which is about harmful content. Is there a high, medium, or low risk of producing certain kinds of harmful content? And if the risk is high, then it's a pretty strict rule. There's got to be age verification. But if the risk is at a lower level, if it's medium, then there's a requirement to establish a whole bunch of risk management steps. Someone at your company, at your business, whose job is to oversee trust and safety. You have to have a mechanism for flagging content that's inappropriate. You have to report to the eSafety Commissioner. You have to communicate with them when they ask you questions. So sort of establishing a baseline of accountability, of transparency, and of a sort of structure around safety is what's really important. But I also have some problems with what's there, or at least I think there are some gaps.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what your take is on like where the gaps and those problems are.
The gap there, you know, and it's just perhaps an unfortunate result of where the regulator has to come from, which is content, right? So you can focus on what the chatbot says and try and stop it or have some guardrails in place. If self-harm content comes up, then you get referred to, you know, mental health services. That's great, but that can't be the whole picture, because the risk doesn't just come from what the chatbot says. It comes from what it feels like to talk to a chatbot. One of the things that it feels like is it feels like you're talking to a person. And that's something that in the tech world, in the world of chatbot, has been known since the 1960s. Even those experiments were showing people attributing human characteristics to this chatbot, trusting it. And then you go and market your chatbot and say, look, we have an AI system with a soul. This is your friend. This AI system can help you with mental health. And you also know that it can unpredictably say all kinds of things, and you haven't controlled very well, you know, what kinds of content can come out. You can just imagine the kinds of catastrophic outcomes, right? So I think the limits on what it's like to use it is really important. And that's something that actually a law last week in California came in. And that, I think, has got some very positive steps in that direction. You know, anti-addiction measures is really important. One of the things that law in California was also going to require is occasional reminders to the user. You're talking to a bot. You're not talking to a human. And from my research, my sense is that that's one of the levers where you get the biggest bang for your buck. And I guess we'll see how that plays out over time.
Yeah, this is Hack. I'm Angel Parsons. I'm speaking with Henry Fraser, a law lecturer at QUT who researches AI regulation. And Henry, we're hearing from a lot of people on the text line. Someone says, I'm a social worker and the amount of clients I have that are developing serious delusions of grandeur after using chatbots and completely checking out of mainstream therapy is incredibly concerning. Someone else says, I own a conversational AI agent company here in Australia. And while I think the Safety Commissioner has done well, I don't think it goes far enough in regulating the services that are available in Australia. Yeah, Henry, if we can go back to April's story and some of the things it revealed, I mean, this person saying that Nomi, the chatbot, encouraged them to commit murder. Nomi didn't get back to us about this specific incident, but what kind of accountability do these platforms face?
When the industry code that the eSafety Commissioners recently registered, when that comes into force in 6 months' time, then there is enforcement of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's an enforceable code and there can be fines of over $9 million off the top of my head. We could also be applying our existing laws to achieve some degree of accountability. I've just opened up the Nomi AI page on my computer in front of me. It says, the first thing it says is an AI companion with a memory and a soul, build a meaningful friendship, develop a passionate relationship, or learn from an insightful mentor. Mm-hmm. These are big claims, right?
Does it feel wrong to you?
I think to make that claim is itself a very risky and dangerous thing to do. On its own, it might be okay, but when you add up all the factors in terms of the types of outputs that you've just described, like to say this is a friend, build a meaningful friendship, and then the thing tells you to go and kill your parents, you put those two things together, it's just extremely disturbing.
And we're focusing on some pretty hectic, pretty confronting cases, but so many people are using these chatbots. Is it all bad? Like, can these chatbots be used for good if there are the right measures in place?
Angel, I'm really glad that you asked that, because it's easy to make a news story about everything that goes wrong. And of course, my research is very much about risks and harms and accountability. But we don't want to sort of get into this mode of being the fun police, right? Where anything new that has some risks is automatically bad, that tech is bad. There are potentially really great uses for these tools. For all of the things that are glitchy and weird and off about it, is far better than feeling lonely and isolated. I think that with proper oversight from mental health professionals, this is the sort of thing that could be prescribed but then monitored as a part of your treatment. I think there are all kinds of opportunities that we could explore, but all of those have to be underpinned by responsibility, and you have to exercise care in order to deliver these things in a safe and responsible way.
It's such a fascinating topic, and it's just not black and white, as you kind of outlined there, and something that's really relevant to so many people listening. So we're so grateful for your insight and your time today on HACC. Henry Fraser, law lecturer at QUT, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Angel.
And on the text line, someone says, I work in IT. These chatbots are already deployed with predefined controls, knowledge restrictions, content filtering, and guardrails. It is the responsibility of the tech companies and how they design their tools. Someone else just saying, why on earth is violent knife use a setting on a chatbot? Shouldn't all that be automatically prevented? Yeah, a lot of questions. It's a big issue governments and tech companies will keep grappling with for now. We're going to change gears a bit and move on.
You're listening to HACC.
A soccer competition proving that even those who are doing it the toughest can still kick life-changing goals.
On Triple J.
Yeah, the task of changing attitudes around homelessness is a difficult one. It's an issue so many people face, but there's a lot of shame, social stigma attached to it. And that's what the Homeless World Cup is trying to do. It's held every year for people affected by and experiencing homelessness. And representing Australia on the Big Issues Socceroos squad this year was 19-year-old Leslie Thompson from Alice Springs. And he just got back from Oslo, where it was held, and sat down with Alice Springs reporter Victoria Ellis.
Yeah, we're all the same. We live in the same planet, same universe. We all might be different country, live in different country and look different, but we're all the same.
Leslie Thompson's back home in Central Australia, having travelled about as far as you can go from Alice Springs. It was his first time overseas, and Leslie flew to Oslo in Norway for a soccer tournament. But the unique thing about this soccer tournament is who played. Everyone there had experienced homelessness.
My teammate kicked it to me, and I was running. Make sure the other team looked far away from me, and I break my patient and kick it to the goal.
Leslie represented the Street Socceroos in the Homeless World Cup. It's a week-long international street soccer tournament to raise awareness and challenge attitudes about homelessness. At about 6 years old, Leslie moved to Alice Springs, which is where he learnt to play soccer at a youth centre in town.
I grew up on Tennant Creek, but Newell Junction is where my family from, and I'm a Katie's from the Katie's tribe.
At the moment, he's crashing in a swag in the backyard of his grandmother's unit. But Leslie has no fixed address and reckons he's experienced homelessness for a fair chunk of his life.
When I was a little kid, I always see my family fighting, come back drinking, yelling, screaming, chucking stuff around. And sometime I go walk along middle of the night to my other family camp, and they live far away, like outside the town. But I walk all the way there, sleep. They're up there for one night, and I go back to my other camp where I need to live.
With Central Australia's long summer months of temperatures regularly over 40 degrees and freezing winters where it can fall below zero at night, sleeping rough takes a big toll.
Sometimes you sleep outside with maybe one blanket or two, or maybe with no mattress. Sometimes you have to look for your family so that you can ask them to give you money to buy food, but sometimes they say nothing.
Leslie is one of more than 2,000 people experiencing homelessness in the Northern Territory on any given day. While Leslie's team came last place in their division at the Homeless World Cup, co-founder of the Big Issue Street Soccer Program and coach of the Street Socceroos, George Halkias, reckons the competition still had a big impact.
It's a very special and unique sporting and football tournament and community event, really. And it celebrates the power of people to overcome adversity and show what they can do when they're given an opportunity.
He says the Homeless World Cup has been going on for about 20 years, run by social support services around the world.
These organisations started to use football or soccer, call it what you will, and sport, to improve the lives of people who might be experiencing disadvantage.
He reckons the host cities and countries of each tournament create a respectful atmosphere to allow people to learn about mental illness, substance abuse, disability, and long-term unemployment.
An opportunity of a lifetime that they can use to learn new lessons, build new skills, and just develop that self-confidence. People like Leslie become great role models and inspire their peers and other people in their local communities.
Back in Alice Springs, Leslie dreams of one day owning his own home.
And I don't want my family to fight there. When they drink, I need them to go sleep somewhere else. I don't want to make no mess in my house.
He also has a message for other people experiencing homelessness.
Don't give up for your life. Do something with your life and you keep on doing something, you'll get somewhere.
Hack on Triple J.
A beautiful story. And thank you to Victoria Ellis there in Alice Springs for bringing it to us. That is all we have time for on Hack today.
Hack.